Yes, no, you can.
Continuing interview with Dr. Joseph E. Group, Wednesday, March 26th. In addition to the University of Haifa, Dr. Eaton, you were chairman of the Academic Review Board of the Mount Carmel International Center for Community Services. What was its function?
The Mount Carmel Institute was organized by the Israeli Foreign Ministry when Mrs. Golda Meir was the foreign minister. She thought that Israel has something to contribute to the Third World. In Theodor Herzl's novel, Alt Neuland, which was written in 1903, I believe, perhaps a little earlier even, he envisioned the Jewish state, and among the other things that he thought the Jewish state would be doing is to give assistance to Africa in freeing that continent and providing some opportunity to move out of the tremendous poverty that existed during the colonial period. And she thought that it would be useful to provide for opportunities to train people. She was particularly interested in women and the training of women, because in the Third World, while women do a lot of the work, most of the decisions are formally made by men, and when it comes to training, this is also true. So that the Mount Carmel Institute focuses on training programs for women, although they do have men come as well.
With emphasis on Africa?
No, Africa and Asia, they are focusing primarily on programs of community development, things that are related to social work, to cooperatives, to the organization of community efforts, nursery schools. And they bring in people for relatively short programs. As I think I mentioned the last time, not more than 3 months at the very longest, so that the people who come never feel so far away from home that they are tempted to question whether they should go home at all, which does happen in overseas training programs in Western countries when people are coming for a degree, when they make friends and possibly get courtship, get married, and so on. And the Israelis also couldn't afford these long programs, because that means maintaining people for a long time. So the Israeli programs are focused on getting specialists who are already working, giving them an opportunity to get some intensive input in their specialty, and then going home. And on that basis, they have had tens of thousands of people coming to Israel. And you find them all over Africa and Asia.
You also stated in your visa that you helped arrange the jointure of the Study Center in Rehoboth and the Mount Carmel Center with the University of Haifa.
Well,
is that still affiliated today? Haifa
agreed to provide academic supervision for the Mount Carmel Institute because they have a professional staff, but they felt that they should have access to people who are more specialized, and Haifa University would provide for this. When it comes to the Rehoboth Settlement Study Center, that really wasn't a jointure. The study center is quite independent, but we offered a professorship to its director, Professor Ranan Weitz, who is a distinguished international scholar, and who actually drove to Haifa one day a week to teach and thereby provide very practical and good instruction to our students.
Also in 1971, you helped develop a joint University of Pittsburgh, University of Haifa work study and research program for Pitt graduate students under the auspices of the GISPIA.
Well,
is this ongoing?
That is not ongoing now. The funds have been exhausted. They were contributed by the endowment fund of the Federation to facilitate the experience of Pittsburghers in Israel and vice versa. And we've had some very distinguished people who benefited from this.
Do you have current contact with the University of Haifa?
Yes, I do. I have many friends there. They've invited me to come back, and I may go back to help them in some research efforts next year. For how long is not yet determined.
I see. Did you, in organizing this, have any contact with Israeli national figures?
Well, yes. Well, we've had, first of all, quite a bit of contact with the Ministry of Welfare and the Minister of Welfare. I would say the most important contacts that I had were really with people at the more operating level. Director General of the Ministry of Education, or the Director General of the Ministry of Welfare, like Dr. Kurtz. The politicians are not really generally worthwhile cultivating because they don't do anything. They can't do anything. They can listen and say, yes, I'll do something, and they'll delegate it right back to their general director, so that other than having very interesting conversations, you don't get things done in the government at that level.
I see.
The important people in Israel, as in the rest of the world, are the people who work at the operating level. The President of the United States doesn't very often make decisions. He may make decisions at a very high policy level, but they're executed by those who are responsible. And what's more important, if you really want to do something, like for instance, when we wanted we had a special training program for social workers who did not get the necessary background to enter a university. And Haifa University had a course to bring them up to the level so that they could go into a master's program. Now, the negotiations of that had to be at the lower level than the minister, because he doesn't have the time to get involved himself in those details. Yes, I mean, my wife gave some flowers to Prime Minister Rabin at one point when she was part of a graduating class of her ulpan, but I'm sure he doesn't remember her, and if we hadn't taken pictures, I don't think it would mean very much to us. But the senior level officials in Israel are much more accessible than they would be in the United States because it's a small country.
Of course. Your career has been so rich and varied, Dr. Eaton, and your vita specifies many honors and awards. And this information, of course, will be filed along with this taped interview in the Hillman Library archives. But we'd like to explore here some especially interesting ones. Could you tell us about your experience as a Fulbright scholar in Africa in 1979? What area did you work in?
Well, the United States government uses some of our funds to maintain contact with and to develop closer relationships to all countries of the world, named after Senator Fulbright. This is a program that provided professors, or anyone whom they invited, sometimes businessmen, to travel in Africa to really do something they are interested in. So my first stop was Liberia, where I worked with the provost, the person who was academically in charge of the University of Liberia, on rethinking the organization of their social science and research program. Dr. James Toppy is a former graduate of ours. I served as the chairman of his dissertation committee, both at the master's and doctoral level. So we had a very good relationship. Liberia was at that time in considerable turmoil. The president had just put down an uprising against him because of the fact that he was head of a pretty corrupt group of leaders. But he was able to manage to survive because he called in troops from a neighboring country to protect him. French-speaking people from Guinea. Although the next year didn't help him because 15 soldiers walked into his mansion and arrested him and later shot him. While I was there, I also assisted the USAID office in some program problems they had, visitors who came they didn't know what to do with. And I worked on a study of corruption in Liberia, which was written up later on in the Pitt Alumni Journal. Was easy to get material on it. I also collected information about the social security and welfare system of Liberia. But after the revolution, nothing got implemented, so what I learned was really outdated by events.
I see.
And from there, I went to Nigeria, where I lectured at a number of universities, and then to South Africa, the Republic of South Africa, where the labor attaché had arranged for me to discuss the Sullivan Principles with a great variety of groups of South Africans. The purpose was to make them aware of the fact that the U.S. had a policy proposed by Reverend Sullivan of Opportunities Industrialization Organization to make the operation of U.S. corporations conditional to doing something for the non-white population in the country to improve their circumstances. And the principles that had been promulgated and the way they were being implemented was something that I had studied. So I made very brief presentation of what these principles were, and then the sessions were all devoted to giving the participants from South Africa a chance to express their views. And the person from the U.S. Embassy who took me to all these places came along because he wanted to learn what their reactions were. It was a way of getting information on the subject, which is much easier that way than to try and interview people, which is hard for the diplomats to just make appointments with people. You have to go through the Foreign Office of the Government of South Africa, and the Government of South Africa says, why do you want to see this person? But if the U.S. Information Service is allowed to organize lectures, and at these lectures they can invite people, and if there's enough exchange of information, we get a better picture of what South Africans think. So I met groups of journalists and groups of black union leaders and groups of black local officials. The groups were generally segregated because that's how South Africa is.
It hasn't changed much.
I would say it looked hopeful at that time that the government was really going to make major changes. Certainly the head of the government indicated that this is something they thought would happen. But it didn't. There's one thing that perhaps is worth telling. While I was there, there was a story in the newspaper of a young girl of age 12 jumping out of the window of an apartment building, and fortunately at the third floor, breaking her hip. The reason was the doorbell rang, and she was afraid that the police were coming to arrest her because she was living in Johannesburg illegally. She lived in the hinterland in one of the so-called homelands, and her parents had absolutely no money, couldn't even pay for her school books at age 12 or the tuition, because black people have to pay for both. They do not get it free at that level as the whites do. So she couldn't go to school, but she wanted to go to school, so she was able to find a job with a white family to take care of the kids, and was planning to save enough money ultimately to go back to school. But that was illegal. Now, the family who invited her, for them it was illegal too. But it's commonplace to get household help that way. So when she thought the police were coming to her house, she jumped out of the window in panic, was injured, and was taken to the hospital. Fortunately, she wasn't seriously injured, but the physicians indicated that she needed long-range supervision by the orthopedists and recommended that she be allowed to stay. Well, the local newspapers reported this very sympathetically, but it was clear that she was going to be deported back to where she came from, where there were no medical services that were really very good, and in any event, when you have a major operation, you should be supervised by the people who did the operation, just for purpose of continuity. So among the appointments I had was with the director of the number two largest corporation in South Africa. It's called Barrows or Rand, I'm not quite sure that I remember the name now. The director of this corporation was an Afrikaner who seemed very liberal. He picked me up with his chauffeur, and we had a very extensive and sumptuous lunch at which he presented to me the program they had to improve conditions for blacks. And they had their own code of conduct that would promise that the corporation would use some of its fund to improve working conditions and training opportunities for blacks. And so I asked him about this story in the newspaper. He was a grandfather who probably had grandchildren that age. And he said, yes, this upset him very much. It's really terrible. And so I said to him, well, isn't there something you can do? He said, well, I don't know what I could do. He said, I told him that if a letter were written to the newspapers by a prominent person like him, that asking for contributions, for money to help this girl to finish school and perhaps go to a university, he would probably raise more than enough money just by writing the letter. Other people would contribute, and it would be a way of showing the government of how much sympathy there was for such terrible things that young children had to be afraid and risk their life because they're scared of the police, that this is really going pretty far in what the apartheid policy does. And he hesitated, but he said, well, I have to think about whether I can do this. And then after the lunch, he sent me back with his chauffeur, who was black. And the chauffeur had listened to part of this conversation while we were driving together in a car. So I gave the chauffeur 50 rand, I think, and says, I want you to give this back to your boss as the first contribution to his fund, realizing what I was doing thereby is really putting him under pressure to actually go ahead and do it. And putting him, what is he going to do with the money if he decides not to go ahead? Well, just before I left the country, I got a special delivery letter containing the money and explaining that after much thought, he decided he could not do what I had suggested. Obviously, he had wrestled with the idea, but to break with his community, and perhaps he was even secretly a senior member of the Brüderbund, which is the planning group that brought apartheid into operation. It just was too much for him, but certainly it is an indication of how difficult it must be for Afrikaners. On one hand, to benefit from apartheid, and yet personally be in no way positioned to defend it, and he certainly did not defend it.
It's a significant story. But as I said, things haven't changed that much.
No, they've gotten worse.
Yeah. Well, the positions have hardened, I think.
Yes. No, I met quite a few senior officials. I was in Soweto, the Ministry of so-called Cooperation of Development, which is the ministry that enforces apartheid. What a name. But the officials who did this were all publicly very liberal, and they really believed in equality but separateness. And when one discussed the differences between the groups, they would correctly point out what you expect. It takes a few generations to move from a completely different cultural background into a modern society. But basically, they really were using all the powers of the police and the state to prevent those who had achieved a great deal already to really fully take advantage of their rights. And one of the senior officials was a German who, of course, what he was doing was so close to the Nazi policies, and this also bothered him. At the same time, he retired with a good pension from the Ministry of Cooperation and Development, and this didn't bother him at all.
Dr. Eaton, what about your involvement with the study tour of Egypt in transition to peace, also in 1979?
Well, the University of Pittsburgh has a informal education program which, among other things, conducts courses and educationally oriented trips. And they decided to organize this education-oriented trip to Egypt. And I was asked to lead it from an academic viewpoint, together with an archaeologist who in the end couldn't come, to provide the participants with input that you can't get from tourist agents and from guides, because they're generally of very poor quality. So I went with them for 10 days, and we saw much of the antiquities of Egypt, and also got a background of the social development and the economic circumstances of Egypt. And while we were there, President Carter was engaged in shuttle diplomacy to finalize the peace treaty, and had flown to Israel to negotiate with Mr. Begin to get some last-minute concessions out of Begin, which he felt were necessary to get Sadat to agree to a peace treaty. And while we were in Egypt, the only way we got news was really on the Egyptian television, and which has an English program for half an hour in the morning and at night. And the way the Egyptians presented it, the Israelis were very intransigent, and the mission was certainly going to fail. And then suddenly came a flash that there had been an agreement, and President Carter would come to Egypt to present his information to President Sadat. Our group was scheduled on that day to go to Alexandria, but we found out just as we were loading the bus that the entire group would have to leave our hotel because the hotel was turned over to the American group. Apparently when the president flies, he flies with not only a large staff, but with a large staff of reporters, and they needed 150 or 200 rooms. And so the Mina House near the pyramid was the hotel chosen. And some of the people who were in our group were in the unfortunate situation that they were already on the bus, couldn't go back. When they came back, they found that all of their belongings had been put in a sheet, lumped together and put out of the way to make room for the new people. And they were to sleep in Alexandria that night in another hotel. Actually, it turned out they didn't need our rooms. And so we were able to move back into them. But we did have the opportunity to watch President Carter's arrival from the airport, because all along the route from the airport to the hotel were policemen stationed, and it's about 4 or 5 miles. There were policemen every 5 feet watching. And the purpose was to have a public demonstration of peace. And President Carter and President Sadat, as they came close to the hotel where my wife and I were standing to watch this occasion, they were standing in an open car for anybody to shoot at. I mean, there would have been absolutely no way to protect them because they were going in the streets and there were houses and you could be stand in a window and shoot them. So I think it took a great deal of personal courage. I interviewed about 29 people who spoke English, whom I met at various places. Most of them were people related to the tourist industry, although some others. And out of those 29, only one was against the peace treaty. And this one was a medical student who felt it was unfair to the Palestinians to make peace without ensuring that they got what they wanted as well.
You were there at a very critical time.
Yeah, it was a very interesting time.
You were a National Academy of Science guest scholar in Poland and the German Democratic Republic on topics relating to social work and social policy in May to August 1980.
Well, the U.S. government has academic exchange agreements with both Poland and East Germany. The one in East Germany is a very difficult one because these Germans are really not interested in having too many outsiders come. They don't want much communication because they realize that there are very few supporters of their regime in East Germany. This is not true of Poland, where I don't think you find there are practically no communists in Poland. I doubt that the head of the Communist Party is a true believer, Jaruzelski. Certainly, the only people we interacted with, well, not the only, but most of the people we interacted with at the upper echelons were formerly members of the Communist Parties in East Germany and in Poland. But the Poles were very much anti-Soviet. And they were nominal members of the party because that was necessary for their career. They were perhaps liberal, socialist in their orientation, but very critical and enamored by what was being achieved in the West.